Session number 4844, Reel 3.
Mr. Prosser, Reel 3. As it was not Movie Tone policy to provide a sound camera, was it possible to hire one commercially in Gibraltar?
In no way. You couldn't get one in Gibraltar, you couldn't get one across the water in Tangier, and I wouldn't imagine there was anywhere nearer than Madrid that you could hire from, and of course you couldn't get over the border into Spain. And so one was absolutely stuck with purely silent operation. There was no way of doing it with sound at all. And one did not have tape recorders in those days, so you couldn't even shoot non-sync sound on a tape recorder as you could today. So I was having continual battles with the office through naval signals to Admiralty about sending me out gear, which they declined to do. And I warned them around the beginning of January, if they hadn't sent a sound camera by that time, I was liable to jump ship and come home and try and get one. I did get a very polite reply from Tony Kimmins advising me to stay where I was, but nevertheless I found that Admiral North was going home in Berwick, and by dint of the kindness of the captain of Berwick, I took passage in her to Portsmouth and arrived there about January the 10th, just in time for the air raid, which pretty well razed the entire city.
What was the Admiralty and Movie Tone reaction to your precipitant return?
Well, the Admiralty, as far as I remember, didn't react particularly. Movie Tone were understandably extremely annoyed, although they didn't fire me, which always rather surprised me. But I was carrying on with ordinary newsreel duties at home in UK, which to some extent after the freedom of being a naval correspondent was somewhat degrading almost in a way. However, I was eventually reassigned to the army in the Middle East, and after a false start when the ship got damaged on the way out of Gurok, we left in April 41 and made for first Cape Town and then Durban, where I was put ashore to wait a flight up to Cairo in the old Imperial Airways C-class flying boats, adapted from the Sunderland aircraft, which was operating until very recently. And after about a month's wait or so in Durban, I made passage up to Cairo, where the first thing I had to do was contact GHQ Cairo about working with the army. This proved to be so frustrating in the sense that I never seemed to be able to get out of Cairo to deal with the army in the desert at all, and it didn't look as though there was much prospect of it, that I made contact with an old school friend of mine who was the naval correspondent for Movie Tone in Alexandria.
This is Norman Fisher.
And arranged with the office through cables that we should exchange jobs and that I should take over the naval correspondency in Alexandria. This was eventually agreed, and I did in fact join the Eastern Mediterranean Fleet there.
How were you accommodating Alexandria?
Now, in the circumstances, it was not practical, we discovered, to live in a ship in the harbour, largely because if that ship didn't happen to go to sea on an operation, one didn't go, and nor did the camera. And therefore it was more practical to live in a hotel, and this was arranged, and it meant that by contact with various friends of one's own and also the Fleet Press Office, one should in theory get enough information in time to be able to take a taxi into the dockyard late at night and join a ship before an operation. And it was always left to the very last minute to do this. On occasions, the Fleet Press Office didn't bother to inform us in time, and if the captain was one whom one knew, sometimes he would get a tip-off from him. He would never actually break security by telling you there was an operation on, but he might say, "Do you want to come and join my ship, old boy?" In which case, he wasted no opportunity. And in fact, there was very little going on in the way of naval operations at the time, and I'd made friends with the captain of Jarvis, who was the captain of, I think, the 16th destroyer flotilla, Captain Philip Mack. And he was extraordinarily good to me. And when he was going on sweeps on some occasions, he would take his entire flotilla to sea with me in Jarvis and put them through all sorts of naval motions, which it would otherwise be impossible to film, because you couldn't do this sort of thing in action. You were never close enough to the other ships to see them, but he would make his ships perform like nobody's business. He was an extremely skilled destroyer captain. As an example of this, in the Battle of Cape Matapan, a little while earlier, on which no naval correspondent was sent, Captain Mack made a signal to Cunningham, the admiral, commanding admiral, pointing out that he'd run out of ammunition in the course of the battle, and he was proposing to blow the stern off one of the Italian cruisers with depth charges, which was his only way of attack at that point. And he was that kind of man who would get away with it. It was a very dangerous operation to do that sort of thing. Anyway, he did this performance for me on a number of occasions, so that I was able to get a lot of tremendously valuable film of destroyer movements and destroyers performing as they might in action. And this could be used in future stories.
For actual live footage, you had to work through the senior officer naval press.
In theory, yes. Generally, it came down through it. Sorry?
How cooperative did he prove to be?
He didn't really seem to know as much as one did oneself about operations, or if he did, he didn't tell us in time very often. But our immediate contact normally was a chap called the Fleet Press Liaison Officer, who had an office quite near the hotel. And one normally made daily visits to him to see if anything was on, and occasionally he'd say, yes, well, there is that, this, that, and the other. But for a long time, they assigned me to destroyers, which were so far out on the wings of any action, whether it was a multiple convoy or a sweep or anything else, that you could very often hardly photograph the other ships in the fleet or the flotilla or whatever you were in. And so I then pressed to join cruisers and eventually made friends with the captain of Dido, and he agreed to take me on numerous occasions. And from then on, after a number of false starts in destroyers, I used to go to sea with him quite a lot. In fact, on every Malta convoy almost after that, I used to go to sea with Dido as a general rule. Other times I used to go up to Tobruk when it was isolated in one of the fast mine-laying cruisers, Abdeel, Latona, Manxman, and I've forgotten the fourth one. Abdeel was sunk very early on in my period. But these were extraordinarily fast ships, could do about 40 knots. It was very fast for those days. So they were one's main line of communications with anything that the Navy was doing around Tobruk. Otherwise, it was going to sea in a cruiser like Dido, occasionally in Ajax or one of the others, or Orion.
Cruisers are still relatively small vessels. Did you find having your equipment on board such a crammed vessel difficult?
Difficult from the point of view of putting a tripod down, yes. Because it meant that you were liable to restrict access of people who know, officers or others, who, the rest of the ship's company that might need to move fast in action. Therefore, one was mobile and one had tremendous freedom of action from the captain, although one normally occupied the bridge until action got going or it became necessary to go somewhere else in the ship. But most of the time you had to work handheld, and because the cruisers vibrated worse than larger ships, and because they were more, from a camera point of view, more unstable in a rough sea, it meant that you generally wedged yourself in a corner in order to get steady pictures and tried to wedge the camera padded by your body against the vibration of the ship. This way it was possible to film quite reasonably well.
Were you receiving, besides Admiralty directives at this time, were you receiving any instructions from Movietone?
Absolutely none at all. I don't remember receiving, other than the cable agreeing to my changeover to the Navy, I don't remember receiving any communication from Movietone, despite continual requests for negative reports and reports on the stories I was turning in, for at least 6 weeks after the first one. And I think I only had about five or six letters in the first year. And they weren't particularly informative about any particular story. Certainly I got no signals about it. The very occasional argument that used to go on about cash supply used to occur, because for some reason, as I'd been originally attached to the army, the office, my office, had arranged to pay me through the field cashier to some character up in Mercer McCrew or somewhere. And as I never got that way in the ordinary way, it was impossible to go and draw money from him. In fact, I opened a bank account with a £10 overdraft when I first arrived in Alexandria, and my money supposed to be cabled from London hadn't arrived at that point, and I had permanent cable arguments with my office at this point about sending money, because I couldn't draw the money they were supplying the field cashier with, and I couldn't get them to understand the idea of cabling money to my bank in Alexandria, where it would have been perfectly simple to draw it. It took the best part of a year and a half to get that organised.
How about supplying the film stock?
As far as film stock was concerned, in theory, it worked quite well, because there was a gentleman called Mr. Roseman in Cairo who worked for Kodak, and in theory, he was authorised by cable from Movietone to supply me with film stock. And I could normally go down to Cairo and draw X thousand feet of stock when necessary. Unfortunately, according to my files of letters, I find that continually I'm expecting a shipment of film via Roseman, and it doesn't turn up, and I'm beginning to run short, and there's plenty of operations coming up, and I want film urgently. Well, occasionally one could borrow it from somebody else. John Turner was very helpful with a few rolls at times if I ran out, and equally I would help him, but normally one got it through Kodak in Cairo.
What cameras had you taken to Alexandria?
Again, the old battle-hardened Newman Sinclair, and I think an IMO this time, so I did have a second camera. But there was no servicing facility for either of them except in Cairo, and then it was pretty odd because the Egyptians weren't ideal camera mechanics. And in fact, I think my Newman went through the war without any servicing other than my own. The IMO did have some servicing on one occasion from a Turk that I discovered in some back street. But otherwise, there wasn't any sort of workshop facility available at all, other than what the Navy could do. They did turn me up another unipod once, beautifully made one, far better than anything ever produced before.
If the senior officer naval press was not perhaps as efficient or cooperative as he might have been, did you find that your connections within the naval service proved very useful? Would you get information through semi-unofficial channels as regards film projects?
I think to say that the naval officers supplied me with information would be suggesting they broke security. This certainly is not true. Other than a captain, ship's captain, possibly saying, "Do you want to come aboard, old boy?" There was no other indication that they were going on an operation. One did have other sources of information, and owing to the very polyglot population of Alexandria, it was even possible to pick up information as to the movement of a cruiser squadron or a fleet or whatever, sometimes even from Italian dockside workers who appeared to be far better informed than almost anybody else about any military operation in the Middle East.
You've described cameramen as having to be patriotic spies. Do you think this is an apt description of the investigative way you went about your journalism?
I think it's probably true. I would hesitate to use that term a second time, perhaps. But it did mean that you had to work very much on your own initiative. It meant you had to find out your own information a great deal. And I eventually ran into trouble through finding this out a bit too well as a result of a phone call I overheard in later years in the intelligence office in Port Said, whereby I picked up a story from a phone call that I overheard in there, and they were making it quite openly in front of me, which merely said that Major Quill had gone north. This tipped me off that there was something interesting in Beirut, and I then made further investigations and discovered that an Italian submarine had been captured with a number of women on board. However, on capture, they put the women out through the torpedo tubes, and the only evidence that there had been women was the fact that some of their clothes were left behind. I did get into a certain amount of trouble over this, but it struck me as rather strange that the intelligence office hadn't picked up the story for 24 hours, until 24 hours after I had.
Were you allowed to send your story home?
Oh, yes. There was no problem having done all that. I sent the story home all right and filmed it and so on quite happily. In fact, I flew up to Beirut for this story with the intelligence officer who was going to interrogate the crew who spoke Italian. The whole thing appeared to be above board, but at the time I was on that aircraft, the intelligence office themselves didn't know the story about the women in the Italian submarine.
So their anger with you was more that you acted unofficially than that you had breached security?
No, it was more the fact they were jealous because I'd beaten them to the story. It was like two journalists in a way, one man who gets a beat on another. And as a result, a watch was put on me, and I was under considerable suspicion for a long time because I'd actually beaten them to the story.
In terms of accommodation in Alexandria, were you rated under some official system as an officer in order for accommodation and rations and the like?
No, in those terms in Alexandria, I was living purely as a civilian in a civilian hotel. I had no rations, I had to pay for everything at Egyptian rates, and I paid my hotel bill and ate there and in other restaurants in the ordinary way. I was merely treated as an officer when I wore uniform to go into the dockyard, for instance. One might periodically be saluted by other ranks in the Navy who didn't notice that one wasn't actually wearing rings, which was more noticeable in the tropical rig when you just wore a white shirt and white shorts with epaulettes, and if they happened to be edge on to the epaulettes, they couldn't see you've got rings and had British Naval Correspondent or something written on them instead. So one had to learn to salute properly in naval fashion and all that sort of thing, because one behaved as an officer as far as one could. And indeed, had one not been dressed as an officer, if one had been captured in action, one would of course have been shot in civilian clothes because you would be treated as a spy.
If you had been captured in your status as a naval correspondent, did the Navy accord you any honorary officer's rank?
Yes, as far as I recall, it was rather strange. The Navy gave you the honorary rank of Lieutenant Commander, but for the brief period I was with the Army, I noticed from my Army War Correspondence license that I was only given the rank of Captain if captured.
Do you think that there were many advantages attaching to your civilian status that helped you in your role as a cameraman?
Oh, heavens, yes. It was absolutely vital that one should be a civilian and remain a civilian, because in those circumstances you were not under anybody's orders except your own office, and they never bothered to communicate with any orders at all. So it meant that you could address anybody from an able seaman to an admiral. You were free to go and talk with and drink with, for that matter, in the wardroom, any senior naval officer to get understanding of the way operations were conducted or were likely to be conducted without breaking security. You could get advice such as I've already mentioned, like what type of ship is a good one to be in for a given type of operation. If you're going to be in a bombardment, you want to be in a fairly heavy ship. No good being in a destroyer outside the bombardment on the edge of the screen, for instance. It meant that when I wanted official information, which I couldn't necessarily get through the Fleet Press liaison officer, I was free to go directly to the Naval Intelligence, Eastern Mediterranean Naval Intelligence Headquarters, and contact Captain Bousfield, who was in command of all Eastern Mediterranean Naval Intelligence. And he was such a decent chap, he was a retired admiral, acting captain at the time for this purpose, that he would, assuming he wasn't in conference, obviously, he would see me almost without an appointment within a few minutes every time I called to his office, which was quite frequently. If I wanted some particular information, again, after all, I'd signed the Official Secrets Act, so it was no question of breaking security on his part. It was an official channel of communication. And it meant that one could do that in the same way one was invited to press conferences by Admiral Cunningham. And one was also free to contact other admirals under his command. There was Rear Admiral Liaison, who was in command of Alexandra as a harbour. There was Admiral Ramsay, who commanded the 15th Cruiser Squadron, and with whom occasionally one also had conferences and so on. And one could, in other words, as a civilian, go and drink on ordinary friendly terms with any officer, and I mean any officer, or you could equally go to the petty officer's mess or the warrant officer's mess, or go down and chat with the able seamen in the mess decks, and you could work with them and you could ask them to do things for shots and so on if you took some lights down, and you were completely free, and except for naval discipline maintenance, you couldn't really be ordered about by anybody. If you actually didn't want to go on an operation for reasons of cowardice or something, not that this ever applied to anybody I knew, as far as naval correspondents were concerned, it meant that you could refuse to go. Your office might fire you if they found out, but it never applied in that sort of case. But equally, if they ordered you to go to a certain ship that you knew was useless, you could refuse on those grounds. And this meant that one was having continual battles with the senior officer naval press, because he would periodically assign people either to the wrong kind of ship or not at all on an operation. And I again have correspondence at considerable length arguing like mad with a certain commander of the time, who claimed that he had not sent or allowed to go any naval correspondence on a particular Tobruk commander operation. His excuse was that there was insufficient accommodation in the ship. This was inaccurate in the first part, because even in destroyers, the captain's day cabin was not in use when in action, and was never used when you were at sea in the ordinary way, and sometimes three or four correspondents even had camp beds on the deck of the captain's day cabin, and usually when you went to sea in the eastern Mediterranean, you didn't have time to sleep, so you didn't, all you did was stow your gear there, and there was no problem, therefore, about accommodation. And this did produce quite a lot of friction, and therefore one tended to make friends with captains of ships who were reasonably useful to you, and make arrangements wherever possible to go to sea with them.
Such
as Captain Mack. In his case, I didn't go very much on operations with Jarvis, because there wasn't anything showing any action per se. But I did go to sea later in several of his destroyers during actions, but they were too far out on the wing of the fleet to be able to see anything very much, which was why I transferred to cruisers later on.
Why do you think in this particular case this naval commander was not anxious for correspondence to go on the Tobruk commando raid? What do you think his own justification for this was?
Well, in all fairness to the chap, the destroyer which I would have gone in was sunk, and any survivors were captured. In fact, one naval correspondent, an American, did manage to go and was captured, Larry Allen of Associated Press. But as he started broadcasting for the Italians later on, this wasn't very popular. But in terms of the reasons for the chap not sending in body, he could claim legitimately as well that it might be a breach of security. In fact, the Tobruk commando raid, the Tobruk commando raid was already broken in security and was known about by the enemy, and therefore it wouldn't have made any difference at all.
This is when the Sikh was sunk.
This is when Sikh was sunk, among others, yes. I just happen to remember Sikh, because that's the only one.
Were there many other cameramen about Alexandria that you knew at this time?
No, only John Turner, who was a naval correspondent for Guermont British, in company with me, and we always used to arrange to go to sea, obviously, in different ships. But no other cameraman normally operated in Alexandria unless he was passing through with the army. There wasn't, to my knowledge, an air correspondent at that time, and towards the end of 1942, the Air Force were just beginning to form their operational film production unit, or their film production unit initially, and a film crew did pass through. But normally the only people one met were Army war correspondents who were going through Alexandria on pass on to the desert, or coming back.
You never met an official Royal Naval cameraman?
Not a film cameraman, no. There were a couple of still cameramen who operated through the Fleet Press Office, whom I used to see fairly frequently, but I don't remember them ever joining me in the same ship. I don't think they ever accompanied me. They may have accompanied me on operations in other ships, but I don't ever remember them actually being in the same ship with me at any time.
Both yourself and John Turner were part of the rota system. Could you explain what this was?
Yes, certainly. At that time, there were five newsreel companies who distributed stories all over the world, in Britain or from Britain, and the rota system meant that any one cameraman for any one of those companies would supply his material through the London office, not only to all other companies of that name over the world, but also to the remaining four companies of newsreels in London who could also distribute it freely over their world networks as well. Which meant that when John Turner and I were filming an operation, we would very often do it to some extent in cooperation, but without any visual or audio communication at all, so that some material John could shoot in a battle, for instance, where his ship might be attacking the enemy fleet, would enable him to show the guns at low elevation for shooting at surface-borne targets, whereas the ship I was in might be shooting at aircraft with high elevation guns, therefore, and I would therefore make a note accordingly on my dope sheet to say that John Turner has cut into the guns firing of this class of ship, you'll have to use his stuff. My stuff is for the air attack, which will match in with his stuff if he's got long shots of the convoy being attacked, and so on. So we worked in cooperation, knowing that our officers were also in coordination in using the material.
John Turner was going on British.
That's right. Yes, I said so, I think.
This system had originated in the war. Do you know whether it was devised by the companies or whether it was imposed upon them by the Admiralty or the government?
No, to the best of my knowledge, it was devised by the Newsreel Association, which was the, if you like, in modern terms, the employers group, which covered the association of all those five newsreels. And it was also applied to royal coverage as well. And in later years, this applied purely to all palace coverage. One man was appointed for a given period, 2 or 3 years, I was later on, appointed to the palace, and he covered for all newsreels in perpetua until he either resigned from that particular post or assignment, or somebody else was replacing him, for one reason or another.
From your base in Alexandria, the most routine operations would have been the Malta convoys.
Yes, that's right. They had to take place in order to supply Malta with everything with which to exist, as it was totally cut off, and almost totally cut off even from air supply. So guns, ammunition, fuel, aircraft fuel, food, to some extent clothing, and almost everything you can think of that a human being, and particularly an army or an air force or a small naval squadron, needs to exist, had to be imported to Malta. Bearing in mind a lot of it used to get destroyed on the way to Malta, and furthermore a great deal got destroyed actually in harbour in Malta after it had arrived, either in the ship that had brought it there or in the course of unloading due to enemy bombing, which was virtually continuous during the daylight hours. The convoys themselves were particularly arduous and unpleasant operations in that they took about 5 days for the Alexandra force to take the convoy just to the outskirts of Malta, where it was met by a Malta squadron, a ship or two, and then return. During those 5 days, we were under continuous attack, day and night, from enemy air bases on either side of us, i.e. in the desert, Greece, Italy, and whatever. We were also under attack from submarines, enemy submarines, and by night we were liable to be attacked additionally by E-boats when we were anywhere near the coast within range of E-boats. This meant that you were on permanent watch and you were almost permanently at action stations. This meant, in effect, that one didn't really leave the bridge except to visit the heads or to go and get some more film from a safer and drier place.
Did you find this fatiguing? Did you find that your concentration lapsed towards the end of a Malta convoy?
Oddly enough, no. I found in wartime your concentration didn't lapse. And I've noticed it even in later years, when I was very much older and probably less fit, that you were able to maintain your concentration for the necessary period. Once you'd finished the operation and you got ashore, you absolutely flopped. And when you got into a perfectly steady bed in a concrete-built hotel, you found that the bed was rocking about you, and it was almost like being at sea. And it was quite difficult to get to sleep at this point, because initially one was put off by this fact that here you were ashore on steady terra firma, and it wasn't steady anymore. This was mentally disturbing, but you got over it in some 12 hours. But it was almost impossible to catch up on your sleep. I very seldom slept for more than about 6 hours when I did finish an operation like that. And I just used to get up, have a meal, do some work. And I'd probably already written my dope sheets and shipped off my film. So I would then prepare for the next operation that might be coming up and go back to bed perhaps for a couple of hours. And then really start working the ordinary daily routine, awaiting operations again.